Special.
I'm recording now, so I have to make sure that nothing happens.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, sounds good.
I don't
want to
do for
John is the Director of Traffic Operations and Department of Transportation. We have the
Office of Alan Jones, Director of Student Transportation at the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction for Randy Gorham.
Hi, I'm Chris Medill, the Director of Program and Services Division for the Commission.
Jerry Nelson, Deputy Assistant to the
I'm going to introduce her in just a minute, so.
I'm Marcia Master, the Service Center Manager. The next item on the agenda is
morning, everybody, and thank you for being here. Just wanted to kind of go over some things with you. Just because I know some of you are new on the commission. We do receive state funds for the commission, but more importantly is for our NHTSA grant funds, is that there are two distinct buckets of funds that we receive, and one is the 402, it's the general traffic safety account that we receive, which has can be used and flexible for a variety of traffic safety programs. So the 402 account, and then we have what they call the 405. Many of you may remember the old safety lieu accounts where we had 402, 405, 406, 408, 210, 211, all those, and it became very confusing. So under the new MAP 21, they now have broken that down into 405. The nice thing with safety, between safety lieu and MAP 21, is that all of the grants that were like the 210, 211, they all had different due dates and disbursements, and it was very frustrating. Now under MAP 21, they go in as one grant, and the funding is, I'll show you in just a second, getting a little better as far as when they actually come to the agency for disbursements. So 405 specifically is the occupant protection, traffic records, impaired driving, and then motorcycles. These distracted driving and graduated driver licensing grants, they're blocked out or light colored because we don't qualify for those particular grants because of our state statutes and other things. So we don't qualify for these, but these four we do. And these are very specific. They're only used for very specific activities and projects listed within these particular categories. Go to the next one. So you can kind of just see over the last 8 years, this is the 402 account, which is our basic grant. These are the other 405 type grants or the safety lieu, 406, 407, 408, all those. This one has remained relatively stable, steady. Last 2 years, there has been slight decreases in these two accounts, or this 402. Challenges we face, obviously, here are as increased costs, inflation rates, everything else that, you know, drives down your buying power. So these are some of the things that we have within 402. Then within the actual grants, one of the things that you can see the spike that we got in 2007, pretty much for our 406 funds, which was used specifically for seatbelt enforcement. So, and that's when we ran those nighttime seatbelt campaigns. We saw great dividends from that. Then, as you can see, it sloped off. We received the last 2 years for 13, and then we'll also receive for 14. It's about $500,000 of funding given to us for unobligated sources from the distracted driving and the graduated driver's license. Now, what happened is, since we did not qualify, the federal government redistributed those in the form of traffic records grants and occupant protection. Or did I do that just opposite? Well, they're both, that's what they're in here for. So they specifically have to be obligated to specific projects within traffic records and seatbelt. Then this last year with Senate Bill 5912, with the DUI changes that we had, or the DUI laws changes, that actually helped us qualify for the first time for the Ignition Airlock Fund. So we got another $400,000, but that $400,000 obviously has to be used for the Ignition Airlock. So this has been kind of, our life for the last 8 years, very steady here, slight decreases. Impacts there. So go to the next one. So in safety lieu, which we had, I think, from what, 2006 through about 2012, and one of the things we've had is what they call carry forward funds. And with carry forward funds, those are funds that you carry forward from the previous year. And the reason why is typically, this is the very beginning of the fiscal year. The federal fiscal year is in October. You're usually using your carry-forward funds until you get your allotments. This is the problem we've had, is how late we get the disbursements. And in 2012, we received predominantly our disbursements at the end of October, when we should have received them, October of the next year. So, does that make sense? So we're receiving these unspent carry forward funds that I have seen, and especially with a lot of my counterparts across the country, is those carry forward funds actually help you to keep your operations going, otherwise you close your doors. So the nice thing is now with MAP 21, the MAP 21 disbursements we've seen now, we've had 1 year of full programming where we've seen we get the allotments either here in November, December, or we get them in March and April, which helps us to be able to plan a little bit better through the year. This is important, go to the next one, because we talked about what's the priority and what's the urgency for us is for the last, since 2006, we saw some significant decreases in our fatalities. Now, this last few years, the average decline is about 1.4%. So, when we look at our programs, we look at the grants, the things that we're going to go through today, is looking at what is the highest priorities, what are the best projects, the best outcomes that we can get, so that we can actually get back on and decrease this rate again. It's kind of that plateauing effect. We want to get back onto that decline. And that's why when we look at these funds here is how do we do that? How do we get back onto that track? And assessing and evaluating all of our programs, all of our projects in order to do that. So, and that is that my last one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any questions on that? Okay. I'm going to turn the time over to Chris, and he's going to walk through. Yeah.
The distracted driving bill that we had that was going through the legislature this year that died had many components that would have allowed us to then qualify for those distracted driving funds. Yeah. Unfortunately, that bill did die in committee. No, in rules. Rules. In the Senate rules. Yeah, it's one of those legislative items we want to put on the priority.
Thanks, Darren.
it's my privilege now to present to you essentially our funding package for the coming fiscal year. So, as Darren talked a little bit about that carry forward amount, the beauty of MAP 21 is that it gave us a single application. We no longer turn in several applications throughout the year, and then stagger the timeline of disbursement. So what that means for us is, and particularly for Debbie, is that given the timing of those disbursements, we feel much more confident in the early allocation to our state and to all states. And now, in this coming fiscal year, our ability to really burn down, essentially spend through in effective projects, some of that carry forward that we have traditionally had. In fact, we've had carry forward like that for every year since I've been here. So if you look at what you'll see in your packets, essentially is there's a comparison sheet. It says a comparison of 2014 approved and 2015 staff TAC recommended. The bottom line is that for last year, our total federal funding, we allocated about almost $11.9 million to federal to traffic safety grants. What we're proposing this year is about $2 million more than what we have historically allocated because of the switch from Safety Lieu to MAP 21. It allows us now much more flexibility to do that. So when we met back in January as staff and looked at the timing of disbursements and how we were getting those funds, it was clear to us that we had an opportunity this year. And we made a change in how we administer our project solicitation process. That was actually 2 years ago. We used to administer grants or our proposal process through this formal request for proposals, an RFP. So we put it out there for a specific time frame. We had people come back, and it was a much more formal sort of evaluative process. The switch we made was toward this much more collaborative process where we're allowing more time during the proposal period, and we're encouraging potential submitters to contact program managers, other subject matter experts, and to talk about how we can get the best strategies into these proposals. In fact, there are a couple this year that we got that we went back to the submitters and said, we like your proposal. Could we incorporate maybe this Target Zero plan strategy to strengthen it? So it's a less formal process, it's more collaborative, and it's really meant to give us better projects to invest in over time. And what we saw this year was we got 85 project proposals, which is about between right around 30 more, 30 to 25 to 30 more than we would typically see in a fiscal year. So it was a good problem to have. We had more project proposals to go through, to evaluate, to read, and ultimately to select as staff and then to run through with the TAC. Several of the TAC members are here today and spent an all-day meeting with us as we did our best to provide summary information of each of those proposals. So we thank them for their time. Some of you know that over the course of, well, let's say at least a decade, we have managed our process with this Access database, this kind of old, antiquated system for tracking proposals and then tracking how we score them and then ultimately how we communicate with those who were approved. Last year, we unceremoniously buried the Access database, not necessarily by our own accord, but we began to have real problems with it and corrupted data. So we've moved exclusively to Excel spreadsheets. We've done our best this year to try and give you some summary information. And in your packets, you have a couple of documents. The biggest is this document that essentially lines out all 85 proposals. It tells you what the title is, who requested it, how much they requested, and then we drafted proposal summaries. That's on the far right column. And try to be as brief as we could. So that's the sheet that we're using kind of as our control document. It lists all the proposals. The first section is a list of those that were selected by for funding by staff and by TAC. The second section, which I think begins on page 10 or so, is the section of those proposals that we did not select. Page 11, we did not select for funding. The other document you have is this comparison of 2014 and 2015 proposals. So this was more just, we wanted to give TAC members and you as commissioners a tool to see what did we do that last year versus what are we doing this year in terms of our investments. So you can see we fund a lot of the same proposals from year to year. When you get into page 2, you'll see that we have several proposals that were funded last year that we're not funding this year, but we also have a number of proposals that we're funding this year that weren't funded last year. So the bottom line on that document is it should be 2014. We funded 38 project proposals. And of those 38, 27 of those grants were either directly to commission or local agencies or had a direct benefit to commission or local agencies. And I'll explain that just a little bit later here. In this proposed package that we have this year, we're proposing to fund 47 projects. 37 of those are directly to commission or local agencies or have direct benefit by commission or local agencies. So at least gives you some idea from year to year as to what we're proposing to fund. The other two documents are, we had a request last year. I know Commissioner Wiesman had asked specifically for more detail around the traffic records projects. So this is one of those specific grants that we receive each year that has to go to very specific projects, data improvement. So Commissioner Wiesman had asked that in this year we provide more detail around each of the projects that we're funding. Now, this list comes from a multi-agency governance group we call the Traffic Records Committee. Commission agencies are represented on that team. Debbie Besser back here is really facilitates that group and manages our state's traffic records program. And you can see there are several recipients of funds. This is one area where we did boost our investments. Last year was about $1 million. This year is about 1.8. And that is all carry forward for the traffic records grants that has to be used for those projects. So this is one area of that $2 million that we're boosting for 2013. This is one area where we're doing that. I want to just show you quickly, this is not any sort of professionally drawn flow, but just to show you quickly how this process works. We really start with the Target Zero plan. In the Target Zero plan, we go through all of the program areas, not just behavioral, but also infrastructure and engineering. We list the strategies that are evidence-based, that are proven and recommended. And ultimately, what we hope to draw from stakeholders and constituents are proposals that use the strategies in the Target Zero plan. So when those come in, we conduct an initial staff review. We provide our recommendation then to the Technical Advisory Committee, TAC, which then reviews and often makes changes. Some of those changes you'll see here today. And then ultimately to you as a commission to say, yep, this is our spending plan for the coming year. That becomes our funding plan for 2015. And then the rest of this is, you can see, ultimately we strike contracts, we provide grants to local agencies. Our program managers, our core program managers, help to oversee and to really facilitate some of those projects. And then ultimately, at the end of the year, we put together an annual report that talks about the work and the progress, things we invested in. So that gives you at least a high-level overview of the process. So I want to get into now kind of the nuts and bolts of what our funding plan for 2015 is. You can see that this is specifically for high-visibility enforcement. And when we say high-visibility enforcement, we're talking scheduled campaigns, for the most part, over time for local law enforcement and for the state patrol. That's part of the requirements around the federal grants. But it's also coupled with a high-visibility media campaign. When you look at the central strategies in the Target Zero plan, high-visibility enforcement, that is the number one strategy. And you'll see it in several places in the plan. But high-visibility enforcement has been our bread and butter for many years, and we believe in its effectiveness. So our investments this year for local law enforcement, for the DUI seatbelt distracted driving campaigns, is about $1.1 million. WSP enforcement overtime for those same campaigns is just under $700,000. We have Target Zero teams. Now, I do want to make a distinction here about Target Zero teams. When we look at what is traditionally considered high visibility enforcement, you couple enforcement with media campaigns. And that means not just news media, where you're trying to generate free media, also paying for TV and radio spots. We have not traditionally done that with Target Zero teams, but you'll see this year our proposal is that we create media spots that we can run in conjunction with Target Zero teams in those counties to generate more publicity, more awareness of those teams and their activities. So that's why Target Zero teams here is listed. The WSP teams that we're using federal funds for in Yakima and Spokane total $1.1 million. And then we have about $650,000 dedicated to local law enforcement in the five counties where we have Target Zero teams. That's King, Pierce, Snohomish, and Yakima, and Spokane. So with that new media campaign, with those new TV and radio spots, we believe Target Zero teams becomes that true high-visibility enforcement, and we think we can push even greater results from that project itself. And you'll see, really, this is the media portion to match the enforcement portion. We're proposing a paid media budget of $1.9 million. If you look at last year's allocation, it was $1 million. The added here is we want to do a better push for Target Zero teams and one also for marijuana-impaired driving. Some of you have probably seen reports from Colorado and how aggressive they've been in their publicity efforts to make the public aware of the dangers of marijuana-impaired driving. Part of the great benefit they had was that there was money specifically for their educational campaign for marijuana-impaired driving. Now, we weren't quite fortunate enough to get that direct connection through 502, but we anticipate with this added funding, we'll be able to put together together a good paid media plan that will publicize the dangers of marijuana and drunk driving. So the bottom line for our high visibility enforcement is about $5.6 million from 2015. Now, 2014 was right at about $4 million. So what this represents is about 40% of our total budget in terms of our federal funding. Typically, high visibility enforcement occupies around 30%. So we're suggesting here, and the TAC agreed, that we boost our investments in high visibility enforcement. We know from some law enforcement that there is additional capacity to do that, that we can invest in locations, that we can get more patrols, and that certainly we can increase the publicity around those patrols. The next group that I want to highlight is what we sometimes refer to as locally led projects. These are on a variety of Target Zero priorities, some DUI, some speeding, young and distracted, but also tribes and pedestrians this year. So I put this map up here just to give you an idea. The total investment in these locally led projects is about $1 million. You can see from the map, the purple counties are those that submitted proposals and were approved. So their locally led projects were approved for funding. Those in pink or the salmon color are those who submitted and ultimately were not selected for funding. There are, you see these little asterisks here. In these counties, they submitted proposals, several proposals. At least one was funded and at least one was not. So you can see, this gives you an idea of where we're getting proposals from in this state. For the most part, these higher populated counties are the ones that are submitting locally led project proposals based on Target Zero plan strategies. Clark County submitted a proposal to do essentially kind of with the Vancouver Police Department, a DUI enforcement focused team. And one of the reasons we found great merit in that proposal, but one of the reasons ultimately we as staff opted not to recommend funding, and I think TAC agreed, is that Clark County is the one that is out there for us as another potential county for a Target Zero team. So that's one area where we said we may hold off for this year, even though the proposal seemed to have great merit. If we were to go into Clark County with another Target Zero team, that would provide local law enforcement funding for Vancouver, but also for Clark County Sheriff and the other smaller municipal departments there. So that's one area just to kind of highlight one of the proposals that we received that we did not select for funding and why. So the last two groups I just want to talk about, we have kind of this group of projects with statewide impact. So they're not locally led, but they have statewide impact. And some of them are required under MAP 21 for us to implement. The first is child passenger safety. We are required under MAP 21 to maintain essentially a child car seat program and booster seat so that we can ensure that we have resources dedicated to the protection of children in vehicles. So we have a coordinator up at the Bonnie Lake Police Department. Some of her salary and benefits come out of this program, but also then work to train inspection or certified technicians and then conduct inspection events as well. The second one is that traffic records group that I talked about. You can see from that document that's included in your packet that there's really about six, and I think there's seven recipients of funding there. Seattle Police Department is one of them that's not listed here, but to the tune of about $1.8 million. And these are projects that are really trying to improve the data we use for program and policy decisions. This includes enhancements to Sector. Some of you know Sector is our electronic ticketing and collision reporting application. Also some DOT systems, trying to improve our ability to use those DOT systems to guide our program investments. We have a traffic safety resource prosecutor. This is the two prosecutors that we fund that really help facilitate efforts to prosecute impaired driving in this state. In this proposal this year, we're proposing to include a training element that would allow one of those traffic safety resource prosecutors to really focus on developing training curriculum for prosecutors around the state. That would include online training, some real innovative stuff to help prosecutors get the kind of training they need for to prosecute effectively impaired drivers. We do have in here a traffic safety summit. We have presented this. We put this proposal in as a commission for many years. This is the first year that as staff, we recommended it be funded, and TAC also recommended it be funded, even though there was some reticence, maybe on just my part, about the amount of work and the logistical efforts that go into hosting a statewide summit. We believe there's great value in it. We believe that bringing stakeholders together in that single summit to talk about a variety of program issues in traffic safety is a good idea. So this year, we have opted to fund that traffic safety summit. Then the last two here, the local coordinators, law enforcement liaisons. This is when we had our special meeting in February 26th, talked about the local implementation program. So we have included $400,000 for the local coordinators, the Target Zero managers. That would essentially keep the same structure and network together through June of next year. And then also $25,000 for our law enforcement liaisons. I talked a little bit about that at our February 26 meeting. This was a program originally intended to provide some overtime funds or equipment to local areas, officers in local areas that could help promote traffic safety. We're not convinced it's the right structure, mostly because we don't see much in terms of reimbursement, and there isn't a lot of activity right now. We have some great ones, and Steve Osback here is one of the shining stars of our law enforcement liaison program, so there are portions of that we certainly want to keep, but we think there could be more effective structure for us going forward in that area as well. The last one is kind of a combination between the Department of Licensing and our staff work to focus on motorcycle issues. We have a specific group of funding through that 405 priority area that gives us money to invest in motorcycles. And so we're going to do that. We're going to do it with enforcement and education. We're also going to do that by promoting training, endorsement, and targeting the areas that are of high concern for us because of the high number of motorcycle fatalities. Just a couple of other notable projects, and then I'll be done. A grants management system. We, for 4 years now, we've had this line item in our proposal. This year, it finally got real for us. We did get a part-time contractor to help manage that project. We just concluded a request for information where we had multiple vendors, I think about a dozen vendors, provide information on their systems. We hosted some presentations so we could see those systems in action. And now we're going through a real detailed requirements gathering phase, which you'll see this butcher paper up here and these sticky notes is really intended to help us flesh out all those detailed requirements so that we can get a system that's efficient but effective too. The amount here, it includes the money that we would invest for that part-time contractor to manage the project and also acquisition costs. Now, the cost that we have in here is an estimate based off of the cost of the most common system used by highway safety offices in the nation. But we saw lots of proposals through our RFI that are much cheaper and much less expensive. It doesn't mean that we'll go there because ultimately we want to have a system that meets our needs. But there is likelihood that this will be much less, but we felt like for planning purposes, it was the right thing to do to put in there the most common system in place by highway safety offices in the nation. So the $1.8 million is the staff salary and benefits from the 402. That's where we pay all the staff and salaries and benefits for this commission. We also have $160,000 for corridors. Right now we have two corridors, one in Yakima and one in Seattle. So that helps those locally led corridor projects implement their improvements and includes some enforcement money to ensure that we're identifying those corridors that need help and providing that. And then the last one is the WSP impaired driving section, which they provide lots of tremendous support for impaired driving in this state, including the Ignition Interlock Program, ensuring compliance for interlocks, Drug Recognition Expert Program, ensuring that we have a good solid cadre of officers in this state that are DREs and that can recognize drug impaired driving, our standard field sobriety testing program, and then also the mobile DUI unit. We provide support each year to get that RV, that recreational vehicle that's been outfitted, to areas throughout the state to speed the process of impaired drivers that are arrested. So, with that, I've concluded my briefing, and I'd be happy to entertain questions, and we flip the lights on, Mark, and anything else that you have for me. Yeah, we anticipate we'll continue to monitor the amount of funding that we come in from NHTSA, but we anticipate that this will probably be a one-time increase in our obligation for the year because of now the transition from Safety Loop to MAP 21 and our confidence now in the timing of those funds and in at least some confidence in the amount of those funds. We anticipate that this will probably be a one-time increase, but we may be able to, depending on funding levels and depending on how much carry forward we anticipate going forward, we may be able to continue at least some portion of over obligation. Good question, thanks. Yeah. Yeah, let me talk about those individually, John. Number 12 is the project for the State Patrol, mostly for enforcement campaigns. So the request came in from the patrol for $548,000. As we had our own discussions, I talked about this proposal process that's slightly less formal. So we have back and forth between submitters now, whereas before there really wasn't much of that going on. So as we got together with staff, as we recognized the amount of funding that we had, we went back to the patrol, and we proposed that we increase funding for the State Patrol for overtime enforcement patrols. They agreed, and that's why we did that, which ultimately was part of what boosted our investment in 2015 for high visibility enforcement. 32, okay. The socks model. Yeah, Soxawaddle, this is a small request from the Soxawaddle Indian Tribe. We made a decision early on in this process this year that because we're really trying to reach out to tribes and because we recognize that there is essentially a data gap, there are fatalities in this state that occur on Indian reservations that we do not know about. We can confirm that. So, as a staff, we essentially talked about this idea of...
I'm sorry, I'm just going to... Really, there's fatalities on Indian reservations and we don't have those stats?
Yes.
Really? I mean, that could be multiple reservations?
Absolutely, yeah. So, a big part of this is the reporting that we have from tribes. It's not very good. So, we want to make a concerted effort to improve that reporting from tribes. They're a part of this state, and we believe if we have better data from them, if we had a better grasp of the size of the problem, we could better address it with the proven and recommended strategies from Target Zero. So this was just one of many projects that we worked with these tribes. They had submitted proposals. We worked with them to see whether we could at least make some incremental steps in individual tribes to gain some headway. So that was one of them. And then 42. Yeah, so 42 is the general communications budget that we use here at the commission. So I talked a little bit about the high visibility enforcement, and our intent we boosted the budget for paid media to go along with the increased amount for law enforcement overtime. We don't currently have TV or radio spots publicizing Target Zero teams. So part of this budget would be the creation, kind of the creative aspect for both the Target Zero teams, but also for marijuana. So for this first push, we're going to leverage some of the work that Colorado has done. And in fact, we're going to use some of their creative spots, their TV and radio spots. There's also some budget in here to create our own marijuana TV and radio spots that would be tailored to Washington. So the increase in budget here mostly is representative of that effort for us to create the materials to go out with the publicity for Target Zero teams and marijuana impaired driving.
And I gave one other question about the distracted driving times. If we get those next year, I'm looking here and we
So there is, Commissioner Snyder, there is on number 30. So we got word about, six weeks ago that NHTSA was going to sponsor a national distracted driving enforcement campaign. They had developed educational media materials that they were going to run. They were essentially running a paid media campaign. And they were asking states to participate with enforcement. So we had about 6 weeks notice to the credit of our program managers and to our Target Zero managers, reached out to our local areas and to the state patrol and said, hey, short notice, we know, we'd love to be able to have your support and participation in this distracted driving campaign. And that's going on. Just wrapped up right at the end of, on Sunday. So this would be a continuation of what this has been, kind of the inaugural distracted driving enforcement campaign. So number 30 would be a continuation of that for next April. But if we were to qualify for those funds, we think the public really supports this. We think there's room to boost our participation in distracted driving. We believe that the public supports that. And we think that there's certainly room for us to improve those behaviors on the roadway. So if we were to qualify for those funds, we would probably add into this budget, this distracted driving budget.
So what is the things that the grant requires on the qualification that we have an estimated volume structure? So if we got a ticket for 124, it could be 125 or 126. There needs to be some escalation of time. And that's one of the things that was in the bill.
So it does mean then qualify for additional funds, not just a different distribution of how we use this.
It would be a whole other block of funds that would come in for that. Like, it was redistributed this time because I think, two states qualified for the distracted driving grants this last year?
is it two or five?
Yeah, very few.
So Congress actually then redistributed those funds back into the states, and that was in the form of traffic records and occupant protection. So those are the places we can use those funds.
About the tribal application, I've seen a couple of these guys. Fascinating to me, I did not know that we collect data that fed into our system. I know we've done some tribal projects in the past, but should more tribes be trying to apply for some of these funds to try to compile the data to find out what the problems are?
Yeah, absolutely. MJ Hott is the program manager that's really working with our tribal partners. And just in the last, let's say, 6 months, it's really been outstanding. We put together a tribal traffic safety advisory board, which had existed many years past. But Darren actually helped lead the first meeting of that advisory board and really trying to create some support in tribes throughout the state to report better data to us, and ultimately have them better represented in terms of not just our data, but in terms of the investments that we're making. Because we know from data that they are at greater risk. The number of tribal members that die on our roadways is much more than other populations. And so we want to find real effective ways to address that problem.
Itself, we are trying to put more funds out in our food strategies and projects to affect that fatality rate, something that really needs to be addressed. So a lot of processes that we're going through to do that and continuing to look and evaluate. But one of the things I want to do today is introduce Joyce Fan. As you know, for the last, 3 years, 4 years, Traffic Records has been trying to acquire a data integration specialist. And with the extra funding, obviously, we have from the Traffic Records grant, which can only be used as a Traffic Records grant, requirements is we're now able to hire Joyce or a data integration specialist. And the timing is about perfect for us because in the new Federal Highways Notice of Proposed Rulemaking under 23 CFR 490, actually suggests incentives for integration with medical records and with injury data. So that is the time is going to be good for us because it's something that needs to be done to look and do the comparisons Rita was there, and she is making the recovery. And it has been a very impressive process. Very sad. The story that he got, and shared his story, and then also Matt Fitt, whose sister was killed last year, out of April, on 5/20. So last March, actually, three weeks ago, I went up to the Schultes Memorial in Seattle, and that was a very emotional event. But it was great for us to be able to be there with the family and to participate with that. They had a nice neighborhood walk that went from one of the donut shops all the way up to the memorial, and it was a really fantastic experience to be a part of that. So, like I mentioned, the Target Zero Awards, I don't see Erica in here. She's not here. Just as a sidelight, we last week survived our first virus attack. Somehow we got a virus into our server, and thank heavens our people came to the rescue and recovered all of our stuff. But it was really interesting. It wasn't the heart bleed that was all out there last week, but very interesting. Is John in here? Do you want to just talk briefly about the fire study and wrap it up?
Yeah. So you mentioned
that
the study by the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, which is a study of low-tide internet. Because these research projects have very some negative things, they and some loss of it. So I'm very, very careful about how we proceed with this. And that means a law enforcement and penalty for your support there. With the SAU and other stakeholders, to come up with a plan for doing these surveys in a way that we are very hopeful will not result in the SAU or not for us. So, we're moving forward, hearing from the best governor to approve our new project and receive that approval. We have one last step that actually we're aware of, which is that. The administrator for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is making one last request to the Secretary of the United States Department of Transportation to approve or do a survey. And I think his request is made by the stakeholder of them to ensure that we don't have negative publicity or any kind of applications for human research projects. So, we're optimistic that it will move forward. We'll know by the end of this week what the Secretary's decision is. We're optimistic he will do a green light and we'll keep you posted on this.
Thank you, John. And then
there's
was mentioned is about the traffic safety, the tribal traffic safety advisory board. Myself and Celeste, I think it's correct. Talos Tribe are sharing that, and that's what we're trying to develop tribes and actually getting some of the tribal members and board members on this advisory board so that we can address traffic safety issues with the tribes. The last thing, obviously, as I talked about, we showed the slide is about our data allocation. And so it's really important that we continue to keep focusing on that and what we're doing. So that we can continue to drive down those numbers. Right now, our projected monthly for 2014 will show that we'd be at 381 if we stayed on our trend line. We are already at 112. And so the projected was to be at 185. So we're well over where we anticipate to be. So as you can see, we're trying to continue to focus our resources on those endeavors. I don't have anything else for the report, but we appreciate all the things that you do to support us. Oh, the last thing is a very special friend, colleague, workmate, is retiring. So, after what? A 35-year career? So, say thank you to Steve, at least in the commission meeting. We'll be having a little get together with him and announcements will be coming out about that as far as the send off. But we're missing, and so just wanted to acknowledge you for all your great work and all your efforts.
Made my job easier because we've kind of already talked about a lot of this. But we're going to talk about what happened in the legislature this year and then get into the distracted driving bill. Ask for support on moving forward with that. And we've kind of already started that conversation, so that's good. So, what passed this year? They set up a different system for getting bills through the committee, which left a lot of, I think, really good bills on the cutting floor. But they did manage to get a few passed. The first one on this list is the theft of spirits from retailers bill. And that one actually is starting to address the fact that we've got hard alcohol sitting in grocery stores, and it's very easy for underage kids to grab and run. It will allow Liquor Control Board to regulate practices for those stores that are experiencing problems. However, experiencing problems means that they have documented an instance where it's ended up in the hands of underage or an adult has helped furnish an underage. So when those things make it sway all the way through to a police record, then Liquor Control Board can take some actions from that store to help them develop policies around how they're storing and displaying alcohol. For us, in the transportation supplemental budget, we lost $100,000 from the school zone safety account. That has meant that right now we've cut off any future funding for traffic safety, school zone safety equipment, flashing lights, law enforcement equipment for enforcement in school zones. Part of that is our success in getting flashing lights up and reducing the number of people who are receiving fines, because flashing lights, we know, are the best way to get them to slow down in those school zones, and the fund is now generating fewer dollars. So it's not unexpected that we can't do that, but I think we were really prepared for it, so that's a bummer. Motorcycles and traffic signals. This is a bill that's been perennial, readily introduced. We've always been not happy about it. The motorcycle petition says that their bikes aren't heavy enough to trigger the light. And so sometimes if the light doesn't trigger, they should be able to ignore the light and move forward. That's really old technology. You know, a piece of aluminum will trigger the light. So it's a shame that it passed. I think they were just tired of hearing about it. The search warrant applications bill will allow for electronic signatures on search warrants. This is critical for us as we're developing our electronic statewide search warrant package. I'm going to make it much smoother to get over that lump of, well, can you really have the officer attest via electronic signature? And the answer is now, yes, we can. So that's really good stuff. 6413 was a small DUI bill that added boating, aircraft, snowmobiles, and off-road vehicles, offenses committed with alcohol to prior DUIs. And then it got a striker that added a whole bunch of other stuff to it, which was nice because the bigger DUI bill had failed. So, again, in a more forceful language, it repeated what we asked for in 2012, which was that repeat offenders stay in jail until they see a judge. Orders that interlock is installed. So a little more forceful language around that. It allows IID in lieu of 24/7. And reiterated that WASP is going to approve these 24/7 programs as they can let them get going. And 2415, another small DUI bill that just said if you committed your felony DUI and you also committed an interlock violation at the same time, that those sentences have to be served consecutively. That's what passed in the realm of traffic safety. What didn't pass? Medical marijuana, liquor control board held a long involved work group to make recommendations to bring medical marijuana in line with our now retail marijuana. Really good suggestions trying to meet the Justice Department's kind of agreement with us. A lot of good measures to keep marijuana out of the hands of children. Unfortunately, at the last minute, it didn't go through. It looked like it was going to. Vehicular homicide punishment would have added 10 years to a vehicular homicide if you had prior vehicular homicides. That one didn't pass. A large work group around therapeutic courts introduced a bill that looked like it was going to make it through, and it got hung up in the end, too. Also, if it didn't pass, would have encouraged more therapeutic courts, including DUI courts, which, of course, you know, best practice. The impaired driving bill was disappointed that it got held up. And some of the things that it would have done that the striker on the other bill that passed didn't do was we've had cases where judges have determined that having your child blow into your interlock didn't constitute circumvention. Defies logic. But we would have clarified that having another person blow into your interlock was indeed circumvention. Would really like to see that go through. The implied consent around blood draws right now is very confusing, and we would like to clarify that language. That didn't go through. Extending the look-back period for DUIs to 15 years didn't go through. Reducing the priors required for a DUI felony from 4 to 3 didn't go through. And the one that I'd like to talk to you about for a little bit, the distracted driving bill got held up and didn't make it through. I passed out the whole entire bill for you, and I'll just give you, kind of touched on it, but I'll give you a little bit of background. King County Harborview Prevention did some really good observational surveys, and what they found is about 1 in 10 people in our state are using an electronic device, or holding an electronic device while they're driving. And that talking on a handheld cell phone increases your risk of crash fourfold. Texting while you're driving increases your crash risk by 23 times. So we know that this is a feature we'd like to discourage. She also did a lot of interviewing with law enforcement and found that many of them feel the current law is vague and difficult to enforce. So, for example, you can hold a device, but you can't hold it to your ear. So is this okay? Is steering with it in your hand okay? I mean, that's an awkward thing that we have about our current law. Texting is actually defined as texting because when the law came about, we had these little flip phones and you had to hold the numbers down to get your ABCs. Do you guys remember that? That was what texting was at the time. We said you can't do that. But now we have phones that surf the internet, so you can actually, when you're stopped saying, well, I wasn't texting, I was emailing, I was checking my Facebook, I was whatever. So we we'd like a law that actually includes what the new technology is offering. So the law that got written was a good law. It would ban all handhelds. So this and this are the same thing. There's no distinction there. It would have banned all the texting that's going on. It would have removed the word moving, operating a moving motor vehicle. By inserting the word moving, our current law makes it unclear as to whether or not you can do these activities when you're stopped at a stoplight. This would clarify that, you have to be parked in a parking lot off the road, not operating your vehicle at all. And it would, also by adding the word, or removing the word moving, it's a violation now that would be reported to your insurance. The new law, as we mentioned, would also double the fine for a second offense. And 50% of that double fine would go into the highway safety account. Let's see. It would require that we ask on the driver's license exam questions about distracted driving. And if we did these things, if this law would have passed, we would have qualified for the distracted driving MAP 21 funding. And we don't know how much money that would be, but only two states qualify, and they basically take that chunk of money and divide it by the states that are qualified. So if we could qualify before a lot of other states qualify, it could be substantial. But so it's helpful, no matter what it is. So what we're asking for from the commissioners is this something that you feel as a commission we could support? And if it is, then we could do some work this summer, visiting legislators, explaining the bill, talking about the funding. We could do editorial boards this fall. There's a lot of students who have been involved in distracted driving campaigns under the State Farm $500 grants. We could ask for them to, some of those came to testify in the legislature, and that was an amazing addition. So we could work to strengthen that, and we could look for the governor and for the legislators for support.
Thank you.
I don't think it's justice to have a two-tiered system that says if your DUI was a result of alcohol, you're going to get this administrative license suspension. Right now, if it's a result of drugs, there's a good chance you won't be subject to that administrative suspension.
And you're not subject to your alcohol cases that involve a warrant as well. So it's
not just
drugs. It's not just drugs because of the changes to the DUI laws. So I actually think this is our role as Traffic Safety Commission to bring forward those challenges that cause traffic fatalities and serious injuries. Any more discussion on that?
Yeah, I think that's great too. That's another. I guess I'm so interested in this, and it's just a formalized process.
Thank you.
shouldn't even be buying it. It's
My only concern is, we talked about the July meeting and you look at the minutes, you know, we didn't have a forum at last July's meeting. So in order to be able to take action like that, where we would actually be, I think, moving from educating legislators on legislative issues to lobbying for it, I think it's a serious enough thing that we need to make sure that there were people for a forum. We couldn't just discuss it and not be able to take a vote on it and have any action. And just from the historical perspective, having been observing here for quite a long time, I know that one of the concerns in the past, and I'm 100% behind any action that reduces distracted driving. So I think it'd be great to have the commission take an active role in that. But I know one of the concerns in the past always was that if you are switching from education to going out there and lobbying for this, I know that distracted driving and the use of electronic devices has a pretty strong voice that is trying to kill that and move towards that. And, you know, I think in the past it was a concern that if the commission gets involved, more directly involved in the politics of controversial issues, that you have to watch out that there aren't political ramifications of taking a strong position. So I would encourage that it be very specific items that, like Steve said, not just saying we want to support a bill, but have very specific things that we want to have included in the distracted driving bill, and such as doubling the or increasing the second offense, things that we need in order to be able to qualify for the federal funds. I think that makes a lot of sense, and I think might help keep us from crossing that line where we're putting a target on our forehead.
The 15-year look back and the felony provision are really controversial, and I believe that our role in those have been to provide information, to let them know what we believe is effective, and because there's a huge fiscal note attached to both of those, I would be hesitant for us to move forward without express governor. The Sentencing Guideline Commission is actually looking at those two things right now, so I feel like it's not going to be completely ignored. The distracted driving, some of the provisions that didn't get picked up on impaired driving, around prevention, around implied consent, I believe, are really important, and we need to, it would be great, I think, to take a stand on those. There's a couple of other items that we could consider, or not, but $2.2 million was removed from the Ignition Interlock Indigent account, and that means that the Ignition Ignition Interlock account will go bankrupt and no longer be able to provide any assistance.
Actually, the majority of our loan will be reducing it to 40%, which because we already were not going to pay you 100% until July 1st or 80% just to get by the money. We want you to try to cover more people. We don't finalize that yet. That's what we're
waiting. So that funding went to DNC for treatment bills. The funding comes to that pot from indigent or from Ignition Interlock users who are actually paying $20 a month to support those indigent funds. But that was something I found. I have to say that we'll look at decreases in impairment and look at our timing with interlocks and the amount of interlocks that we're now able to increase. Those things, I think, have been really positive for increasing fatals.
So, that would be a third item, replenish the interlock. So,
I go slow. I'm just kind of one time I have an extra one.
Okay, that's
awesome. I don't know.
And I guess that I would like to say, I mean, I've spoken to the legislature for several years, and you have to stay focused, and if you get your life and get you spread out, and you can get a weaker point, and I think that if these are the two things that we really are passionate about, which I think we are, this is where we're going, is this is what we should be as a commission, this is what we should be focusing on.
So I guess I'm going to motion to stand this. Yes. Motion to support the court provisions of 27, 28, and 16.
Will we stay with the rules of the lease? Will we have to change? We have to change, right? Because my memory is the only one for the day. So
the court provisions.
Just the court provisions. That's why I think that's right. And that will require
staff to particularly the court provisions and send that to the
applicant.
Okay. We're waiting. All in favor to make that motion in a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yes. Why I'm telling you in our agency, it's very true that I can't speak for the other commissioners. Achieve on 18 to 21 year olds. I think this is really important. over to Amy first and then Bruce to do a presentation. Thank you.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to share the results of our early warning program. I will briefly talk about why, as an agency, we implement this program, and then Bruce will present the early results. Several years ago, COL hosted a high school course effort to identify who the identity drivers are. And the task force is to press with the multiple state agencies, law enforcement, private citizens, and nonprofit organizations. And the conclusion from that task force is three distinct groups should be considered for intervention as at-risk drivers. They are the young drivers, the older drivers, and the impaired drivers. So following the final report of the task force, DOL considered all the findings from the task force, and also along with the former governor's request, we determined that we needed to develop a predictive model to identify the individual at-risk drivers. Just similar to how the healthcare industry created a predictive model for high at-risk patients, like the high cholesterol level may be an indicator for potential heart disease. So we studied 5 million Washington driving records and looking for this indicator or predictors for the future collisions. And we found a near perfect correlation between an increasing risk of collision with increasing number of violations. So the more violations, the higher risk for collision. And based on all this record, we developed our own predictive model. From that model, it was very clear the younger drivers pose the greatest risk to themselves and to others. So especially those between the age of 18 to 21, because those drivers, they are beyond the reach of the intermediate driver restrictions. So the decision was made to initiate an early warning letter program as an early intervention, sending a warning letter to the young drivers age group after the first moving violations. So the program was implemented in March 2011, and we are sending about more than 2,000 letters every month. By now, we have about 10 months mature data we can look, we can study, and we are very excited to share with you the early results.
So with that, I will let Bruce to present you the actual findings from this study. I have 25 seconds. I'll talk fast. I'll hide my address. Red button. Real briefly, going through the basics of the early warning letter program. 18 to 21 years old, after they get their first moving violation, remember it's the first one that gets them in the program. Okay? The violation makes its way to DOL for inclusion on the record. Now, we'll talk about how long that takes, but overall average about 90 days. Not always, though. Once it's in, on the DOL record, the first of the month after we get that on the record, we send out an early warning letter to that individual, which basically says, we know that you've done this, this is what the violation is, your odds of being in a collision have now doubled, so we'd like you to be safe. It's not punitive in any way, just advisory. And then we wait 2 years for adjudication to take place, and I just said it takes about 90 days, but We'll explain later why we waited 2 years. March 2013 marked the first two-year period from the beginning of the program. So in March 2013, I could look at the first results of the March 2011 people that we sent the first month's letters to. The objective of this process is to reduce the repeat offenses by young drivers. Following that, we'll determine the impacts on collision, serious injuries, and fatalities if we can. There's three possible outcomes. We'll either increase violations, which we certainly hope we don't, or we decrease them, which is where we want to be, and or there might be no change at all. I want to cover a little bit about the methodology here. What we see here is that the early warning letter group on top, March through December 2011, is what we're going to talk about today. We wait 24 months and we do the analysis on them, what their behavior was month for month, March to March, April to April, and so on and so forth, for 24 months. As a measurement stick, we get a control group, and we start that in March 2009. I go back in time to static files we have, and I pick up these people. Now, it was really interesting that it was a near mirror image. Same number of violations, same number of people, and everything was matched up really well. And again, we go month to month for that same period. So we've got a control group or a comparison group, if you will, and our early warning group, and we later on see if we made a difference. We use the same ages, violations, time frame, data sets, but there's some weird timing things to account for, and I want to cover that so that nobody says I'm full of beans. We get about 4% of the population that get a second violation before we get the letter to them. In other words, they get a letter in April, and in May they get another violation, and in June we find out about it, and then we send them a letter. Well, they've already become a recidivist, and we didn't know about it. Another 4% have a violation working their way through the courts that we don't know about yet, so we don't know about them until they're processed. But then they get a speeding ticket, which is pretty quick turnaround. They pay their ticket. We send them an early warning letter, and they still got something else cooking in the background. A little example down here. An individual, say, gets a failure to stop in July of 2011. We find out about it in September. We send them a letter in October. Case closed. We did our job. Except we find out in November that they got a speeding ticket in August. Well, okay, we didn't meet our goal there. And then we find out in January that way back in April, they got a serious one. They got tied up in court for quite a while. So this particular theoretical example tells us that the individual that we thought got their first violation had already gotten a second one, and before that he had one in the pending out in the courts. So they meet both of those criteria. So this concerned us when we started seeing this come about. We thought, oh, but are we able to meet the goal that we want to go, what we want to meet? So noting all that, we had to ask ourselves, are we meeting that goal? And we said, yeah, 92% of the time, we get the letter to the person at the right time. The other 8% we can't control because it gets tied up in the courts, and or the person is a quick repeat offender and we can't get to them in time. But 92% of the time is pretty good odds. So you'd ask if it was a 90-day average turnaround, why we wait so long? The violations, the type of them vary a lot. There's mandatory court requirements for some, the more serious ones. You get a reckless driving or a DUI or something like that, you're going to go to court. The speeding one, you just drop your payment in the mail. The average time to posting, that's from arrest to the time DUL puts it on the record, is about double for the more serious stuff, alcohol, drug, and this is kind of a hodgepodge of all the serious violations. The inattention or lack of experience or the driving errors, failures, signal, that sort of thing. And speeding, you'll see why it gets its own category here in a minute. The law enforcement here, I'm sure, already knows why. first violation is the youth and reckless behavior, as I titled it. Thrills and lack of experience. It's like they have their own roller coaster all of a sudden. Alcohol and drug related, pretty small potatoes in the big picture here. Then the reckless and negligent, some. Driving errors, a fair amount, but look at speeding. And if you put those all together, that equates to 70% of all of their first infractions are a speeding ticket. They like to drive fast. So getting to our findings, we have 10 months of data that's been collected. It makes up a little over 47,000 records. About half of those are control and half of those are the study group. We want to know if there's a reduction in secondary violations. Now remember, everybody that gets into this study has at least one violation. That's the criteria to get in. And what we see is with the early warning group, 64% have only one violation on their record in that two-year study period. But with the control group, 52%. In other words, 48% got more than one. So the answer is, yeah, we're seeing a 12% reduction in secondary infractions in this study group. We'll get to what that means in numbers in a second. Look a little bit about some of the demographics, age differences. We say if they made it to 21 before they get their first living violation, they're probably better drivers. Well, yeah, that's true. You see an increasing percentage of the people that got only one violation with increasing age in both groups. But note that the control group has a lesser percentage in each age category. Looking at gender difference, I hate this one. I just hate this one. Every time I try to omit it, somebody catches me. The males, 18 to 21 years, again, the same basic pattern, upward trend with increasing age. Now, these guys, if they made it to 21 years old before they got a moving violation, it just makes common sense that they're better drivers than the 18-year-olds that got theirs at that age. But I find it interesting, look at the 18-year-old male control group, the yellow bar there, 43% got one violation in 2 years. That means 57% got more than one. It's pretty bad. We flip that around to 54%, and all the way up to 65% for the 21-year-old early warning letter recipients. And now we look at the females. And we'll skip right over there. The bottom line is that females always do better in the violation category. And impressively, the 21-year-old female early warning letter recipient, 72% stopped at one violation. So what does this mean to traffic safety? Now, if we're going to use our predictive model that was referenced by Haiping. And what that does is determine the correlation ratio between violations and collisions. We've already done that math. We've got a handout for you if you'd like to take one with you. It's a big grid. And it's fun to look at where you are on there and to see what your odds of being in a collision are. I would wager, based on the audience, probably about 3 to 4%. From there, we're going to take the serious injury and fatality rates from the Washington State Collision Data Summary that was released recently. What we end up with is an estimate of serious injuries and fatalities avoided, that's the operative word, proportionate to the reduced number of violations and collisions by the early warning group. Okay? Now, the next one is, if you don't like math, close your eyes. What we start with is a little snippet of our predictive model. And what that basically means is if you have zero violations here, your odds of being in a collision in a year's time are 4.7%. Well, nobody in this group has zero. They all have at least one. So a lot of them have one, their odds are 8.7. And if you have two violations, your odds increase to 11.3 and so on and so forth. If you have over five violations in a given year,
18.5% of those people are going to be included. Almost 1 out of 5. So what we do then is we calculate the avoided collisions. And we know the violation count of the individuals. We know the difference between the early warning group and the control drivers. There's more of the ones, which is a good thing, that's what we want. And there's less of the twos and threes and fours. We multiply that by the collision likelihood of these guys. And we end up with some mostly minuses, some pluses, and a net reduction 317 collisions. Now, we'll take the fatality and serious injury counts from 2012. These are real numbers. These are theoretical numbers based on logs. These are the real numbers, 36,204 and 13,833 total collisions. We take the fatality rate, which is 36 over the collisions, and the serious injury rate. And then we apply that to the 317 collisions that we have avoided. And what we ended up with is about 1 avoided fatality and almost 5 avoided serious injuries. Now that's all based on a letter sent to some people at low cost, not requiring legislation, without any punitive impact. So to summarize, when you count up the number of violations received by the control group and the early warning group, we have a little over 9,000 secondary infractions avoided in 10 months. 12% reduction in violations. Every age, both genders, had an increased likelihood of remaining at 1 violation. In other words, we cut out the secondary violation. We stopped the train. Extrapolating those reduced violations using a predictive model, just to summarize, 317 probable collisions avoided, 5 probable serious injuries avoided, and 1 fatality avoided.
Yeah.
This is as quick as I could do it. It wasn't 25 seconds. Catering it maybe to the violation type, you mean?
Yes.
That's one option that we go down, we can look at. There's a few options of things that we might want to consider to fine-tune this thing. I was just happy to get it off the ground a couple of years ago, and then now it's a little fun to see what's happening with it. One of the things that we thought about is just that, looking at specific violation types and then cutting it out and then cater it more to that individual's particular behavioral problem. Another thing is to look at age expansion, but the further out you go, the less likely the people are to be getting their first unit violation. And if you go out to say age 25 or 30 and they get their first violation, you have to ask yourself if they really are a risk if they got to age 30 without getting any tickets. So that's what I guess.
I remember your original presentation for the older drivers, mm-hmm. you started showing the increase again.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, rather than doing a age 30, if we might want to look at
the other end?
Yeah, look at the other end.
Another good option.
80 and above.
Sure.
Or some arbitrary number that I'm not close to yet.
Sure. One thing that I wanted to add that might be something we can consider is these are moving violations only. Now, as you know, there are some non-moving violations that we might want to seatbelt violations, for instance, driving without insurance, that sort of thing. They don't count in this. We don't send those guys a letter. Well, we might want to start doing that. So that's another option. So we've got a couple of good thoughts here.
And maybe and earlier transit lead times, and if you're going to go into a collision, then maybe you can start giving that message out to people that are
out there. Yeah, if we can frame it in a manner that makes them think. Yeah, and that is definitely a thing for them.
Sure. And all we're saying
the personal touch, if you will, might mean something to them. It might just. Sure. Got a couple of questions. John? Internally, we looked at a number of options, and in fact, we fine-tuned the letter a little bit down the road because some of the language was we found some heartburn with some of the parents. They thought it was perhaps too rough. I didn't think so, but so internally, we kind of vetted it, and then it kept morphing, and finally it came up with a product, and we morphed it again. So it's not enough that. The message is the same, it's just delivery is a little softer. Sure, we'll get that on you.
Shut this down because I shut that particular slide down because I didn't want to. There you go. What did I do? There we go. Oh, well, okay. What this boils down to. Oh, now we're in business. Turn her back on. Get used to your okay. This particular thing showed up in the Olympia newspaper. It's the warning letter rankled some parents, and our friend Austin Jenkins wrote it. My daughter, not cool harassment. My daughter went to court. The red stuff's all you really got to read. She paid her ticket, didn't deserve any additional reprimand. So and so says it's just not necessary. They should focus on serious lawbreakers. Well, we looked at this particular person because somebody knows how to go in and play in the database. I won't mention any names. That's just we definitely won't mention any. That's probably illegal. She got her speeding ticket, and DOL posted the citation, and then DOL sent the early warning letter, and then NPR started a release. Pretty quick movement on the mother there, and a month and 20 days, she got a newspaper article, expressing her outrage. Well, that was in July. The following April, she got her second speeding ticket. And then in August, she got her third speeding ticket. So you got to wonder if maybe the behavior of the child is kind of following the behavior of the parent in this case. So it's refreshing to hear the other side of the story from a parent who had a litter. Anyway, there was another question over. Stacy, do you have one? What? About math? Let's go.
Yeah. Stop here. Just the yellow one.